It's the morning of January 6, 1855.
Right.
And a massive 1,700-ton ship called the Ebba Brahe is sailing into Sydney Harbor.
Finally.
Yeah, after 83 agonizing days at sea, standing at the rail is this 21-year-old woman named Mary Barn.
Just watching the coastline.
Exactly. She's watching this low green shore slide by, which, you know, looks absolutely nothing like her home in Carlow, Ireland.
Not at all.
But then up the mast goes a yellow flag. Quarantine. Which means even more waiting.
Ugh, the worst.
Right. But what Mary doesn't know is that a small boat is already rowing out toward them. And sitting in that boat is an immigration clerk.
Just holding a blank sheet of paper.
Yes. A blank sheet of paper getting ready to record an accusation that is about to make Mary like the most talked about woman in the entire colony.
I mean, it really sounds like the opening scene of a historical thriller.
It totally does.
But every single detail of that moment and the massive scandal that followed is preserved in the surviving colonial archives. We have the trial minutes, the ship's logs, all the defensive letters.
Which is wild. And I'm so glad you're here with us today because unpacking that stack of records is our exact mission for this deep dive.
Absolutely.
But we aren't just looking at the shipboard drama, you know, just for the sake of gossip.
No, definitely not. We're looking at this through a very specific lens, the lens of a social and family historian.
Right.
The goal here is to really explore how ordinary people, and especially vulnerable immigrants like Mary, actually managed to survive these massive bureaucratic systems.
Systems that were basically designed from the top down to control them.
Exactly. We're tracking how someone transitions from being, you know, a mere subject of colonial scrutiny, like an unwanted name on a scandal sheet, to the foundational bedrock of an entire family lineage.
Okay, let's unpack this
by
figuring out exactly who Mary Byrne was before she ever even set foot on that wooden ship.
Yeah, let's look at her background.
So the records tell us she was born in 1833 in Tinryland, County Carlow. She was a Catholic housemaid, and by the time she was a young adult, she was an orphan.
It's a very stark, flat, bureaucratic description when you read it.
It really is. But if you look closely, she had this one detail on her record that really stood out. She could read and write.
And that detail, honestly, is the hinge her entire story swings on.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. If we connect this to the bigger picture, to understand why an orphan housemaid is boarding a ship to the other side of the planet, we have to look at the macro social history.
Right, because Ireland at this time was completely reeling from the Great Famine.
Exactly. The potato crop failures from 1845 to 1852 hadn't just, you know, caused hunger. They had caused complete societal collapse.
Wow.
Disease, eviction, starvation, it had just scattered the population. So for a young orphaned woman with no land and no safety net, there were essentially zero choices left.
I was trying to wrap my head around the scale of that leap. I mean, it's basically like signing up for a one-way 19th century mission to Mars.
That's a great way to put it.
Like, you're never coming back. You're never seeing anyone you know ever again. But she wasn't doing it for the thrill of discovery, right?
No, not at all.
It was literally the only sensible move left on the chessboard if she wanted to survive.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the world, the British government had a crisis of its own.
Oh, right. The labor shortage.
Yeah. They were facing a massive labor shortage in Australia because the male workforce had practically vanished overnight.
They all bolted for the newly discovered gold fields.
Exactly. So the colonial government had to manufacture a new workforce.
But I mean, how exactly did they pull that off? Because shipping tens of thousands of people across the globe is incredibly expensive.
Oh, it was a massive undertaking. They funded this assisted emigration scheme by selling off crown land in Australia.
Okay.
Essentially, the government took vast tracts of land, sold it to wealthy colonists or investors, and used that direct revenue to subsidize ship tickets for desperate Irish and British laborers. They were practically begging for single young women to come work as servants just to, like, stabilize the colony.
That economic engine is just wild to me. Selling land on one continent to buy desperate humans from another.
It's a very blunt system.
And the sheer terror, coupled with the immense bravery of that choice, it really hits you when you look at Mary's intake paperwork.
Oh, her paperwork is heartbreaking.
Right under the column for family in Australia, it just lists no relations in the colony, no one is waiting for her.
But as we mentioned earlier, her ability to read and write was a crucial anomaly.
Because for a poor Irish Catholic girl in the 1850s, literacy was incredibly rare.
Exactly. And the colonial authorities desperately valued that skill to help maintain order on the chaotic journey over.
Oh, so because of that literacy, they were going to give her responsibilities.
Yes. It essentially predetermined her fate on the ship.
Which is how Mary ends up walking up the gangplank of the Eva Brahe. It leaves Plymouth in October 1854 with nearly 400 immigrants on board.
Mostly Irish immigrants.
Yeah. And a ship like this wasn't just, you know, a vehicle. It was a floating, sealed kingdom. And it had a very bizarre, almost contradictory division of power.
It was completely bifurcated. You had Captain Robert Pollock Davison. He commanded the sailing of the ship, the crew, the rigging, the physical vessel itself.
Okay, that makes sense.
But he had absolutely no authority over the passengers.
Wait, I need to stop you there.
Sure.
Why would the captain of a ship not be in charge of the people on the ship? That just seems like a recipe for constant power struggles.
It really does, right. But it was actually a direct response to a previous public health crisis.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In the early days of emigration, when sea captains were in charge of everything, the mortality rates were just catastrophic. Captains cared about speed and cargo, not hygiene.
Oh, of course. Money over people.
Exactly. The government realized that putting a medical doctor in absolute charge of the emigrants' diet, discipline, and daily routine kept far more of them alive.
Okay, I see.
So they stripped the captain of passenger authority and handed it to the surgeon superintendent.
So it's essentially making the captain the CEO of the building, while the doctor is like the head of HR with absolute unchecked power over the employees.
That is a perfect analogy, yes.
And the surgeon superintendent on this particular voyage was Dr. Louis Foucart. And I gotta say, this guy's profile is something else.
He is quite the character.
The sources say he was the son of a French fencing master who rode with Napoleon's Imperial Guard.
Right.
And Foucart himself loved to brag to anyone in earshot that he had treated the great British statesman Sir Robert Peel at his deathbed.
Very modest.
Yeah. He was highly arrogant, deeply aristocratic in his bearing, quick-tempered, and completely convinced of his own brilliance.
And this is the man given absolute authority over 400 frightened, exhausted people.
Yikes.
His daily life was dictated by 57 number duties outlined by the colonial government. He was the doctor, the disciplinarian, the judge, and the record keeper all in one.
That's way too much power for one person.
It is. But the mechanism that actually kept this entire system running was something called the gratuity.
Right, the bonus.
Yes. He was paid a substantial bonus at the end of the voyage, but only if the colonial authorities in Sydney judged that he had run a healthy, orderly ship.
Wait, so they put a highly irritable, arrogant guy in absolute charge of 400 vulnerable people.
Yep.
And his primary paycheck depends entirely on making sure no problems are officially reported. What could possibly go wrong?
I mean, it creates a massive conflict of interest. The financial incentive is to suppress bad news, not solve it.
Definitely.
You also have to understand how the single women were managed. It was a bizarre mix of genuine physical protection and, like, intense Victorian paranoia about their respectability.
Because the unmarried women were fenced off in the stern of the ship, right?
Yes. They were literally locked into their compartment at night behind a grate.
Just like a prison within a prison.
Pretty much. This enclosed community was ruled by a matron, usually an older woman appointed back in London, and underneath her were sub-matrons.
And these were just young women plucked from the passenger list.
Yeah, exactly. To keep order, stop the girls from talking to sailors, and take the night watch.
Did they get paid for this?
No, they weren't paid wages. They were only hoping for a small gratuity of their own and a good character reference at the end of the trip.
Both of which were completely controlled by Dr. Foucart.
You guessed it.
And into this deeply flawed, highly pressurized system, absolute tragedy strikes. Cholera.
Yes, the worst case scenario.
He comes aboard early, and along with measles and chickenpox, it just ravages the ship.
It's awful.
You have to picture the reality of this. A locked wooden box, no ventilation, the heat, the dark, the smell.
Unbearable.
By the time they reach Sydney, 16 people are dead. And it's mostly young children. You read the official list in the archives and it is gut-wrenching. Kids like 4-year-old Rose Martin.
The sensory and psychological horror of an outbreak in those conditions, it really cannot be overstated. The sources contain these vivid, agonizing scenes.
Yeah, I read about the sailmaker.
Right. The ship's sailmaker, stitching a dead child into old canvas, putting the final stitch through the nose, as was the naval custom.
God, that's dark.
And then just a small, clean splash as the body goes over the side into the dark water. Everyone on board is watching this happen.
It generates an atmosphere of intense, suffocating grief and terror.
And under that kind of psychological strain, the social order on board just fractures completely.
Which is when the firing starts.
Exactly. Barely a week into the voyage, Dr. Foucar fires the older matron, a woman named Elizabeth James.
And then a few weeks later, he goes after the ship's nurse, Anna Clements.
Right. He fires her too. He claims Clements was stealing medical stores and trying to stir up a mutiny.
But I mean, whatever the actual truth is, by officially firing them, he didn't just hurt their pride.
No, he stripped them of their posts and, crucially, their end-of-voyage gratuities.
Wow.
He basically used his authority as financial blackmail. They were now facing a rival in a new colony with no money and a ruined reputation.
So Foucar obviously needs to replace them.
He does. And because Mary Byrne is sober, literate, and highly capable, she gets promoted to sub-matron and is handed the night watch.
Which just exposes all the deep social fault lines on the ship.
Oh, absolutely. You have poor, mostly Catholic Irish emigrants being governed by English Protestants who openly viewed them as ignorant and, well, of an inferior class.
See, here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Mary is a 21-year-old girl stepping into a policing role over her peers.
Yes.
Some of the women called her rather impudent and no favorite, while others insisted she was perfectly well conducted.
The opinions were very split.
But to me, Mary wasn't necessarily playing the teacher's pet to the arrogant doctor.
No, I agree.
She was a strict, competent kid doing a highly unpopular job keeping scared, bored, sick people in line.
Precisely.
And because she was doing the doctor's dirty work, she became the absolute perfect target for these recently fired, disgruntled older women who wanted financial revenge on Foucar.
That dynamic is exactly what sets the stage for the night in question.
Let's get into it.
It is past midnight, December 6, 1854. The ship is dark, a child is crying in the hospital bay, and Foucar goes below decks into the locked single women's quarters.
And from here, history splits into two wildly conflicting, totally cinematic accounts. Let's look at version A.
See, version A.
This is the story told by Mrs. Clements and Mrs. James, the two fired women with a massive grudge.
Right.
According to them, Clements wakes up, hears whispering, and calls out in the dark, "Mary Burns, where are you? I want some ginger, Mary Burns."
Like that.
A lantern is suddenly raised, a curtain is pulled back, and boom, the doctor is seen standing right at Mary's bed wearing an old plaid coat.
Very dramatic.
Yeah.
But then you have version B. This is the account given by Mary, Foucar, and crucially, the other women sleeping just an arm's length away.
Okay, what do they say?
In their version, Foucar was down there to treat a sick child. While he was there, he found a water closet, you know, one of the ship's toilets, flooding onto the deck. So he was down on the floor with a swab, clearing the blockage. Clement calls out for ginger for his stomach ache. Foucar hands her the ginger, locks the hatch, goes up to the deck to smoke a cigar, and goes to his own bed.
Wait.
Yeah.
Hold on. I have to push back here. You're telling me this wildly arrogant guy who brags about riding with Napoleon's guard and treating Sir Robert Peel is down on his hands and knees swabbing a flooded toilet in the dark at midnight?
That is the official story.
Does anyone actually believe that?
Oh,
it sounds like a frantic excuse someone makes up on the spot when they get caught somewhere they shouldn't be.
It absolutely strains credulity. Foucault's ego makes it very hard to picture him acting as a late-night plumber.
Right.
But what's fascinating here is that the absolute objective truth of what happened in the dark that night is permanently lost to history.
We'll never really know.
Exactly. Anyone who claims to know for certain is projecting. But as social historians, we aren't detectives trying to solve a 170-year-old cold case.
Okay, so what do we care about?
What we really care about are the mechanics of the accusation itself.
What do you mean by the mechanics?
I mean how a woman's reputation could be weaponized in a confined, gossip-starved space.
Oh, wow.
Whether the doctor was in her bed or unclogging a drain, Mary suffered immediately. The rumor spread like wildfire.
I can imagine.
For 3 days after that, sailors literally hooted and jeered at her when she walked on the deck. She couldn't move without being insulted.
That is horrible.
Her character, which was literally her only currency for securing a job and a safe life in Australia, was being systematically destroyed.
Because if she's ruined, the doctor's ruined, and he loses his precious gratuity.
Bingo.
The fired women were using Mary as ammunition to shoot at Foucar. Which brings us all the way back to our opening scene.
January 1855.
Right. They arrive in Sydney Harbor, and the ship is thrown into quarantine at North Head. H.H. Brown, the agent for immigration, boards the ship to inspect it.
And the complaints just flood in.
Instantly. Six young women, including Anne Freeman and Susan Lowe, officially complain about the doctor. And several states, for the record, they saw him go to Mary Byrne in the night.
It escalates so fast.
It really does.
Yeah.
It's no longer just nasty ship gossip. It becomes a formal colonial board of immigration inquiry.
And the board sits like a court over 7 days. You really have to picture this environment.
Okay.
You have these wealthy, established British colonial gentlemen in tailored coats sitting behind desks, looking down at exhausted, impoverished immigrants.
The power imbalance is staggering.
It really is. They hear the accusers. Then they call Mary Byrne to the stand.
It must have been terrifying for her.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
And yet her testimony is remarkable for its steadiness. She tells her plain version of events.
What does she say?
Well, when the board asks her point blank, you are aware of the report that was circulated respecting your having gone into the doctor's bed. Is that the case? She doesn't waffle.
No.
She gives this incredibly brave, bare answer. She just says, no, it is not.
Wow. But she wasn't alone up there, right? It wasn't just her single word against a gang of angry women.
No, she actually had a lot of support.
Yeah, a whole wall of peers stood up to defend her. Mary Kelly, Margaret Kelly, Bridget O'Hare, the women who literally slept in the berths directly above and beside her.
The ones who would have known.
Exactly. They all testified that Mary went to bed alone, that they absolutely would have woken up if a man climbed into the berth, and they aggressively vouched for her character.
One of them explicitly called her a really innocent, pious girl.
Meanwhile, Dr. Foucard decides the best defense is a wildly unhinged defense.
Oh, his response is legendary.
Right. He submits this massive, rambling, written rebuttal to the board where he attempts to blacken the character of every single girl who spoke against him.
Just tearing everyone down.
He even drags Captain Davison into the mess, officially accusing the captain of fraud and incompetence.
He was so out of control that Captain Davison actually got a hold of the document, sat there, and coolly annotated Foucard's lies in the margins.
Just completely contradicting him.
Yeah.
I just love the mental image of the captain sitting there with a pen, writing, nope, that's a lie, right next to the doctor's aristocratic ranting.
It totally backfired on Foucard. So on April 26, 1855, the colonial board delivers its verdict, and they do not hold back.
What do they decide?
They completely disregard the evidence against Mary. They rule that the entire scandal was a malicious and wicked conspiracy orchestrated by Mrs. Clements to get revenge on the surgeon for firing her.
Wow. So they saw right through it.
They did. Clements and James both lose their gratuities permanently, and Mary is officially cleared of all wrongdoing.
The board did censure the doctor, right?
Oh, yes.
They called him out for his total lack of discretion and for inappropriately promoting a young woman he clearly favored. They essentially told him he'd never get command of another emigrant ship.
They did. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, the real question for us, looking through the lens of family history, is what happens to Mary after the gavel falls?
Because while these wealthy colonial gentlemen were safely arguing over his virtue in a wood-paneled courtroom, Mary was just trying to survive her first week in a new country.
Exactly.
She ends up as a statistic in a Sydney Morning Herald notice. She is literally one of 31 unnamed housemaids sitting at the Hyde Park Barracks hiring depot, just hoping a stranger will walk in and offer her a job.
The contrast is jarring.
It really is. Being the white-hot center of this explosive trial and then just sitting quietly in a hiring room is staggering.
This raises an important question about how we view the people of the past. If you stop the story at the trial, Mary Byrne was nothing more than a scandal.
Right.
A bureaucratic problem to be adjudicated and filed away. We would only know her through her worst, most stressful weeks.
But there's more to it.
Yes. When you switch your focus to family records, specifically probate packets, a completely different reality emerges.
Let's clarify that for a second. What exactly is a probate packet and why is it so valuable here?
Good question. Probate packets are essentially the legal inventories of everything a person owned when they died.
Oh, I see.
They are gold mines for historians because they tell us exactly how much wealth, land, and family a person had accumulated by the end of their life.
Okay, so when we look at Mary's...
When we look at the probate packets from 1885 to 1904, we see Mary's true trajectory.
So what happens to her?
Well, within a couple of years of the trial, she marries a man named John Kelly.
Okay, good for her.
Sadly, she's widowed soon after and left with a young daughter, but she doesn't break. She marries a man named William Zaltzenbach.
Oh, wow.
They leave Sydney, move out west to the Lawrence Lake District, and start over.
She becomes a true pioneer.
She becomes wife Mary in those estate papers. She builds a farm, she raises a family, she accumulates land. She becomes the foundational bedrock of an entire Australian family line.
That is incredible.
The frightened 21-year-old girl, the orphan from Carlo who was jeered by sailors and dragged into a colonial court, outlived the worst weeks of her life to create a massive, lasting legacy.
And there is such sweet, poetic irony in how it all shook out.
Oh, completely.
Dr. Foucar, the guy who started all this chaos with his arrogance and his bizarre late-night plumbing excursions, he never commanded an emigrant ship again. His reputation was cooked.
Done for.
He ended up staying in Sydney and became a local musician. He joined the Philharmonic Society.
Talk about a career pivot.
Right. But the young housemaid he carelessly placed in the center of a malicious conspiracy quietly went out west, bought land, and built a real life.
It's a profound reminder of resilience. We really have to remember that historical archives, by their very nature, are almost always records of people's absolute worst moments.
Because they're written in crisis.
Exactly. They are written by bureaucrats or by enemies or generated in moments of severe trauma. An archive captures the worst day, but it almost never captures the whole life.
So what does this all mean for us today?
Well, it puts things in perspective.
Yeah. We followed Mary Byrne's journey from a starving, literate housemaid in Carlo to taking that terrifying leap onto a ship with no relations waiting for her.
A huge risk.
We explored how the strange, flawed mechanics of colonial emigration, you know, from land sales to gratuities, created a toxic environment. We saw her become the target of a wicked shipboard revenge plot fueled by class tensions, sickness, and financial greed.
The perfect storm.
And ultimately, we saw her as a survivor who outlived her own scandal to become an ancestor.
The archival records leaned heavily in one direction. To the colonial government, she was just a problem.
Right.
But in reality, she was a capable, devout young woman doing an unpopular policing job well, publicly shamed for a crime a court decided never even happened.
And when the trial was over, she just walked out of the barracks, dried her eyes, and lived her life.
Which is the best part of the story.
It really makes you think about how we are all documented. Think about the overarching theme we've explored today. That the archives only capture our worst days.
That's a scary thought.
Imagine if a historian, 170 years from now, tried to reconstruct your life, but the only sources they had were your most stressful bureaucratic records.
Like a bitter lawsuit.
Yeah, a bitter lawsuit, a messy medical file, a really bad HR dispute where everyone was angry. How drastically would they misunderstand the person you actually are?
They get it all wrong.
Would they see the whole picture, the family you built, the resilience you showed? Or would you just be the name written on a blank sheet of paper by a clerk rowing out to a quarantine ship?
It's definitely something to mull over.
It really is. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.